not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own my special interest groups that fund their campaign.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, we begin by talking about political repression and dissent in the United States, both post 9/11 and in the Trump era. We'll hear from two National Lawyers Guild activists, Caitlin Henry and Lale Babyhanian, regarding new anti-protesting state laws around the United States and more. Later in the program, we'll be joined by Veterans for Peace activists and the Golden Rule Project. Helen Jacquard and Jerry Condon will discuss the history of the peace boat, the Golden Rule, and their current voyage along the California coast. Please stay with us.
Thinkable crimes perpetrated by the criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguised under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide wars fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by taxing while the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons filled with capacity citizens, hypnotized by the master thief, confined and conquered.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. On the first segment of today's program, we're going to be talking about political repression in the United States, the suppression of dissent in the United States. Certainly, we'll talk a little about the history of those issues, but we're going to be focusing more in the recent past, and particularly since the rise of the Donald Trump presidency. And we are joined by two expert guests. And here is my co-host, Peter Phillips, who will introduce them to you. Peter?
Caitlin. Henry is an activist with the National Lawyers Guild. She's an experienced criminal, civil, administrative, and transactional law attorney. Her experience includes national security, post-conviction civil rights, public records, corporate travel, watch lists, private technology, human rights, and other practice areas as needed for social justice. Lale Babyhanian is a professor at UC Berkeley. She teaches political sociology, and she did her dissertation on the Occupy movement in Oakland and how that was repressed by state power. So welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Caitlin, let's just start with you. Tell us what is happening at the state legislature level across the country to repress civil liberties and the ability to protest.
Across the nation, Republicans have introduced approximately 29 bills in 20 different states and have succeeded so far in enacting approximately 16 bills. And I think Lale is going to speak to the details of those bills.
What we're seeing is actually quite alarming in a lot of ways. There's a number of things that are happening with all of this proposed legislation. One is that we're seeing a real kind of intensification of the severity of protest-related offenses. So there's a range of proposals to really enormously kind of increase the severity of charges, the jail time associated with charges. There's over a dozen states at this point that have proposed bills to increase jail sentences for protesters who are charged with obstructing traffic. In that case, very clearly kind of intended to target particularly Black Lives Matter protests. There have been kind of similar bills that are calling for increasing the severity of trespassing or obstructing on infrastructure like pipelines, in some cases reclassifying that as felonies, very clearly targeted at indigenous protests like the Water Defenders at Standing Rock. And even just proposals to increase the severity of the most minor charges like failure to disperse. For example, there's a bill proposed in Virginia to increase the penalty for unlawful assembly to up to 1 year in jail. So we're seeing this kind of intensification. And in some cases, it's actually happening by attempting to link protest-related offenses to what's called terrorism or organized crime. So in Arizona, there's a bill proposed to include rioting under the state's racketeering laws as a form of organized crime. A couple of states, Washington, North Carolina, there have been proposals to officially designate protests as forms of what's called, quote, economic terrorism. And we're seeing all kinds of efforts to classify things like obstructing oil pipelines or infrastructure is environmental terrorism. One of the alarming trends is this kind of really increased intensification of the severity of protest-related charges. But there's also a kind of push to create a whole range of new protest-related offenses. In particular, the most common thing that's happening is there's bills all over the country criminalizing the wearing of masks at protests in particular. But even down to some much more ridiculous proposals, like, for example, criminalizing the heckling of state officials as a criminal offense.
Laughing, in particular.
Laughing, yes. Yeah.
Laughing is a crime.
Laughing is now a crime. Yeah. Yes, it is. Feeding is a crime. Laughing is a crime. I guess we shouldn't be so surprised. So there's this intensification of severity. There's this creation of new protest-related offenses. There's also a kind of push to use different kinds of punitive mechanisms in addition to jail time, and particularly a range of efforts to impose financial penalties to people who are arrested at protests. So there's efforts to authorize the protesters to be charged for policing costs that are incurred. There's even efforts to use anti-racketeering laws in some states as a means of seizing the assets of protesters. So essentially civil forfeiture in a manner that's been really similar to what's long happened in the war on drugs. And there's many, many proposals that essentially are aimed at facilitating the ability of corporations like oil companies, like banks, to pursue civil claims against those that protest them. So we're seeing these kinds of new forms of penalties, even down to states that are proposing to mandate that all community colleges in the state expel any student convicted of a protest-related offense. So this is really kind of alarming, the increasing kind of criminalization of protest. And I would say the final really concerning thing that we're seeing is there's also an effort to kind of expand the realm of liability, meaning a range of proposed legislation to make people liable for things under the terms of collusion or conspiracy. And some of that is happening through proposed legislation. Some of it's just happening through really questionable reinterpretations of pre-existing statutes under this Trump administration. So one thing which Caitlin can speak to in more detail is the case of those that were arrested at Trump's inauguration on January 20th, at the protests against Trump's inauguration. There are 214 people that are currently facing federal rioting charges, felony charges, and facing up to 85 years in jail for this.
That's just utterly staggering. And Caitlin, can you speak to that, the J20?
230 people were arrested, but many of the journalists are not being prosecuted. On May 31st, they were heard with a motion to dismiss from the defense. There are multiple felonies with decades of charges, 8 felonies for people who were merely at a protest for the inauguration, who were trapped by the police, weapons were used against them, they were not free to leave, and they are being implicated for conduct of other people that happened an hour later and blocks away. So they have filed a motion to dismiss. The state is attempting to coerce people into pleas to legitimize this prosecution. And I think that both the laws that Lale has discussed, as well as the implementation of those laws, are very selective in who they're used against. And they're attempting to curtail free expression and association. And the fear of these prosecutions is being used to demand obedience to authority and to discourage political activity. And we see that in many places trending towards fascism as a real red flag, the squelching of protest and defense to that dissent by the state is something to be very concerned about. And I think the context here that is very, very important to make is the state's endorsement of these tactics emboldening vigilantism, specifically white supremacist, masculinist attacks and right-wing attacks, whether it's outing undocumented and trans students and calling for violence against them, or actually engaging in violence in bars, on trains, other public places, or going to people's homes or places of worship and attacking them. The ways that these laws have been implemented parallel what we see in many other contexts of reinforcing racial hierarchies, being selectively used to target primarily Black and brown folks, and some of those themes that Lale spoke about, I think, are particularly interesting because they further punished already marginalized groups. And as she talked about paralleling the war on drugs, we see this criminalization happening through a sort of militarized enforcement and then the prosecution only being brought against certain people. So I think that we see a lot of the criminalizing in reaction to different tactics that specific movements have used, whether it's Black Lives Matter movement, indigenous sovereignty movements, increasing minimum wage, or immigration movements. There's specific criminalizations of tactics that those movements use.
Caitlin Henry, I want to point listeners to the National Lawyers Guild website, of course, nlg.org, an article from March, New Anti-Protesting Legislation, A Deeper Look by Tracy Yoder, the Director of Research and Education, outlines some of the things that we're discussing. So if listeners want more information, they can go to nlg.org and look up the Yoder article, among others. And Caitlin Henry, I wanted to get a little more specific, if possible, regarding the so-called J20 and the, you mentioned, 230. There are several other factors here. One, of course, that we deal with the Project Center Show is the lack of media, corporate media coverage in particular, of these issues, or the framing and context of the coverage if they do get any kind of attention. And the other is a lack of specificity. We've been researching these couple of these stories for our next book, including what's happening here with the Washington, D.C. case. And only a couple people were writing about this particular issue, and that was about the police confiscation of people's phones, the Fourth Amendment issue. CityLab's George Joseph wrote about this. Sarah Lazare at Alternet picked this up. Most other journalists are not picking this up. And it brings up a question of the Supreme Court case on Riley v. California and what the police are able to do. Could you talk a little bit about this? Because this is a case where, and I think this is the broader ramifications of this, the silencing of dissent through this, is it has far greater possible ramifications than just the people that are targeted. It's clearly designed to have a chilling effect on suppressing people's First Amendment rights by also targeting Fourth Amendment rights. And one of these stories is about how cell phones were confiscated. In a couple cases, cell phones were taken. Not only were they taken without warrant, but they were later taken or attempted to be taken from people who didn't even have them physically on their person while arrested. Can you comment at all on the Fourth Amendment and implications of that in this case?
Well, I'm more interested in the sort of counter-democratic surveillance, and I think Lale has a lot to say about that, than the Fourth Amendment issues. They are confiscating cell phones. As we know, for the Fourth Amendment, the exclusionary rule to exclude evidence only applies in the event that there is a prosecution, and there are issues, Fifth Amendment issues, on whether somebody's material in their phone can be used against them and their right to be free from incriminating themselves, and that's distinct from that being used against somebody else. So if it's unlawfully confiscated, the exclusionary rule and what's called the fruit of the poisonous tree, the derivative evidence rule, where anything that comes from that is sort of tainted and able to be used, only matters in the sense of prosecution. But I think that we're interested in this trend of surveillance, whether it's through drones and what we know to have come out recently in North Dakota about the collusion of the state, the pipeline, and private mercenaries, in this rise of surveillance and videotaping people's faces, doxing people, and these implied fears that are slightly different than these regressive and punitive laws that we talked about before. Lale, I'm interested in hearing what you have to say about surveillance specifically.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this issue is crucial, and it's quite illustrative that those phones were confiscated, and there's nothing uncommon about that anymore. And I think what it points to is really how central surveillance is to the state's repressive strategies right now. And I think there's two major strategies that we see in relation to protest and dissent in this country. And one is this highly militarized, tensely violent response that we see in places like Standing Rock or in Ferguson, for example. But there's also another strategy where in certain cases, we see law enforcement very much takes a hands-off approach, allows whatever happens to happen. In often cases, you know, especially in the cases where there are, let's say, white supremacists that are counter-protesters, not really intervening in any way, and focusing instead just on documenting what's going on. And that was very much the case, for example, in the protests around Milo at UC Berkeley, right? There was very little kind of any police intervention whatsoever.
Milo Yiannopoulos, formerly of Breitbart.
Yes, thank you. And instead, the strategy was just to kind of step back and document everything. And so what you'll see, instead of seeing riot-geared officers with all kinds of less than lethal munitions, you'll see more and more of them with surveillance devices. And the purpose of that is to then be able to identify people later for prosecution or for other forms of surveillance or harassment. So I think we have to think about that, these kinds of the state's strategy of surveillance in this moment, but also see that in relation to this increasing strategy among the alt-right or white supremacists or whatever we want to call them, neo-Nazis, fascists, of themselves undertaking those same forms of surveillance strategy. So doxing protesters or those that they identify as being organizers or activists. And, you know, there have been numerous cases of protesters who've had their personal information, their home addresses, their telephone numbers, their family members and their telephone numbers and home addresses, their place of employment, all made public by various alt-right groups on the internet, and then have become targets of really vicious harassment, death threats. You know, people's mothers are getting death threats in the middle of the night because they're seen as being organizers or activists that these groups don't agree with. So that's the reality right now of dissent or protest in this country. It's increasingly a situation where to be able to go out and protest or dissent in any way means making oneself vulnerable, not only to increasing state repression, which, as we've been talking about, the consequences for which are becoming increasingly terrifying, potentially 85 years on federal charges just for being in the vicinity of something that happened at a demonstration, as well as making oneself vulnerable to targeting by essentially what is an emboldened vigilante, alt-right, white supremacist kind of movement in this country.
Well, we know what doxing means, but just in case someone in the audience doesn't know, can you just briefly tell them what that means?
Caitlin.
Yeah. DOX or DOXXING is something that has been around for a while, but called different things. So it's for documents or data about somebody that could be publicly available or not publicly available, and it's culled typically off the internet and compiled and released in a way that implies that somebody should go to some place and take action. It's an invasion of somebody's privacy, whether the information is or isn't public. There's something called mosaic theory, and there's other ways of conceptualizing how putting together various parts of private information that may or may not be publicly available. There may be intrusive hacking that violates some kind of laws, or it might just be culling data that is there from different sources that publish it quite ethically questionably or legally questionably. But given the nature of big data, so much is out there, and once it's out there, it's hard to get back. So doxing is used to compile information and really portray a picture of somebody's social graph, typically, and imply that that person should be attacked, condemned, or
intimidated. Some kind of intimidation tactic. Thanks for explaining that. We're speaking with Lale Behbehanian and Caitlin Henry. We're talking about political repression of dissent in the United States, criminalization of dissent and surveillance, a wide swath of topics, and we'll continue that conversation after this break. Please stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. In this segment of the program, we're talking about political repression, certainly repression of dissent.
mass surveillance. And our guests are Lale Behbehanian and also Caitlin Henry. And before the break, we were mentioning several things in defining doxing and so forth, but we want to come back here now. We want to kind of go back to Lale. You wanted to round out some of the ideas that you were talking about prior to the break.
Yeah, I mean, because I think that we have to think about some of this stuff in relation to each other. We have to think about, one, this increasing reliance on surveillance on the part of the state. And just to clarify, I kind of use that in an academic or jargony sense of, you know, not just referring to the state of California, but the state meaning government, right? So on the one hand, we have this surveillance strategy on the part of the state. On the other hand, we also have, as we just discussed, this alt-right strategy of doxing. And if we boil down what doxing is, just down to, you know, the most basic, simple definition, I would say that it's publicly making people identifiable as targets for violence, harassment, or other forms of abuse. So thinking about that reality in relation to these efforts to criminalize particularly the wearing of masks. And I would say that if you look at all of these legislative proposals, that's probably one of the most common push in the legislation is to make it a criminal act in this country to mask up or to essentially disguise one's identity in any fashion when engaging in protest. And I know that it kind of, on the surface, it seems like, well, you know, if you're not doing anything wrong and if you're not engaged in any criminal activity, then why the need to mask up? Peaceful protesters, you know, don't need to mask up. That's something that, quote, Antifa does or the, quote, Black Bloc does. But that has to be understood. And it's an increasing tendency that can't just be ascribed to the Black Bloc or Antifa. I mean, we see people in Ferguson covering their faces. We see protesters all over this country doing so. And that is a response to a reality that people understand of the kinds of risk that one takes on by dissenting in those forms. So one thing we really need to do is really rethink maybe some of our assumptions of what it means to be a peaceful protester generally, and really think about the risks that are being incurred and how, you know, essentially to demand that people unmask or to criminalize people's, you know, masking up at protests means essentially to say that making yourself vulnerable to extreme state repression or violence by the vigilante right is the price that any, quote, peaceful protester should pay for expressing that kind of dissent. And that has really horrifying implications for the potential for protest and dissent in this country.
We should add in a layer about companies and mercenaries and private involvement. We did clarify when we're talking about the state, we mean government in general. And we have seen and discussed in this show so far federal prosecutions in D.C., but there are many state laws. In the beginning, we introduced it with 20 states, but I want to focus specifically on North Dakota and the collusion between the state in terms of non-federal but state level, and then companies and mercenaries in repressing indigenous people and supporters in solidarity with them. Do you want to talk a little bit about the Standing Rock revelations?
Well, I mean, I think that you should, but the one thing that I would say, you know, is a kind of preface that we should keep in mind about Standing Rock and about all of this is, at the end of the day, no matter what's presented in the media, you know, the Black Bloc or whatever, at the end of the day, the primary targets of these repressive strategies again and again are often Black and brown communities that resist, right? So in the case of Standing Rock, what we know is that all of those people who are currently facing federal charges for their participation in the protests at Standing Rock are all indigenous people. And so the most severe kind of federal repression is coming down on them. We already brought up, just as another example, the case of the protest against Milo at UC Berkeley. Of the three people arrested in relation to that, two out of three were Black men. So I think Caitlin can really speak about the details of that, but that's something that we need to keep in mind is that, you know, it never affects everyone equally. And part of the purpose, because, you know, this kind of wave of repression is coming in response to what is actually a really a moment of resistance across this country, whether indigenous resistance, resistance of Black Lives Matter, resistance against the persecution of undocumented immigrants. And so we need to keep those issues of race and who's really being targeted at the end of the day in mind about all of this.
The idea that someone is masked or even partially hiding their face. So hoodies were included in the North Dakota law, that if you had a hoodie on, you could, in fact, and you were participating in what was defined either as a riot or a protest, that could be a $3,000 fine and a year in jail. So those are quite repressive. Now, historically, in the 30s, there were laws against the Klan hiding their faces, and which were not highly enforced, but they were definitely on the books. But this is taking it a whole lot further. I mean, these are people who are publicly out there standing up for human rights, so to speak.
In the winter.
In the winter, and being violently repressed. And in some cases where riots occur or the police attack, and certainly the police fully dressed are actually their faces are more hidden than hardly anybody else, or certainly that's a factor as well.
And certainly, as we talked about, since the war on drugs, the militarization of police, their gear makes it more so.
Exactly.
What's so different about being concerned about the fact that phones are being taken from protesters on January 20th and masking, because at the heart, both of them are about a right in this country to not have to identify and expose oneself to the government, right? So this notion that you are supposed to voluntarily identify who you are to the government while you're in the process of some form of political dissent is, I think, is grossly misunderstanding what the real kind of heart of our protections of privacy in this country are. The Fourth Amendment, those provisions are there to entitle all of us a kind of space in which to be able to rebel and to express that dissent and not be clearly identified, transparent to the government. That's the whole point.
And I was asked to talk about North Dakota a little, so I want to bring it back to what both of those points. So organizations that are supporting people in North Dakota are also being criminalized and threatened with up to $1 million fines for supporting people to protest. So the three bills passed in North Dakota, HB 1293, HB 1304 and HB 1426, all increase penalties. One expands the scope of trespass activity for any sort of demonstrations and then increases jail time and fines. At the same time, in North Dakota, they've been increasing the level of money needed to post bail in a really regressive fashion, while most jurisdictions are moving to a more progressive non-monetary bail because they recognize that so many people in California, 75%, I believe, in 2017, I believe that's the number of people in our jails are there on pretrial inability to pay bail status. So increasing the punitive nature of that. Another bill, as Peter alluded to, that prohibits concealing any portion of your face, for example, in the winter in North Dakota, could encompass many different things. And it's now going to be a Class A misdemeanor punishable by up to 1 year in jail or $3,000 fine. And the last one is changing the definition of riot. And the federal case that we talked about for the inauguration demonstrations was charged under the federal riot offenses, and this is a state-level offense about riot offenses. And participation is a Class A misdemeanor, which is punishable up to a year in prison, a $3,000 fine. But depending on the number of people, if it's a mass popular mobilization, as happened at Standing Rock, it's a more severe penalty, subject to 10 years in prison and $20,000 fine. And organizations that support that are also at severe risks of up to $1 million fines. So I wanted to just come back to that point.
That's certainly significant in terms of what we've been talking about here today. In terms of the repression of dissent, has a lot of other intimidating factors to it. It seems like there is definitely a chilling effect intended when you're facing down those astronomical kinds of economic figures or financial figures. That's clearly enough to deter people.
And there's some legislative analysis that talks about that, and then there's publications from Tiger Swan, the company that was implicated in the Intercept article, talking about that specifically with deterrence and trying to deter people from participating in dissent by bail. But all these economic disincentives we're seeing increased fines for protesting, asset forfeiture for planning or attending a demonstration, enabled law enforcement to sue protesters for the cost of suppressing their very protest, prohibiting government from funding individuals and entities that promote or engage in boycotts, requiring schools to expel students with protest-related convictions, and those really hit already economically marginalized people harder. And a lot of the movements we're seeing are economically marginalized people asking for equality.
Indeed, we're also seeing, in terms of surveillance on minors, FBI has been working with schools around the country to surveil and target specific student groups, particularly people that they believe are Muslim. There seems to be a direct targeting of even young people, meaning minors, that's going on, and it doesn't seem to be discussed very widely at all.
In some ways, it's not that surprising because all of these developments are happening in response to the wave of repression is happening in response to a tremendous wave of resistance, right? This really is a moment in this nation where there are all kinds of struggles against economic inequality, against white supremacy. So that's the reason why we're seeing this kind of backlash, both from the state and from the alt-right. And I would say that it's not surprising that minors be targeted in this fashion by the state because, you know, if we think about it, especially immediately around the inauguration and the election of Trump, as is often the case, it's really the youth who kind of put their feet on the ground first. And they have been, we often don't recognize it, but they've really been at the forefront of many of these movements. And so, you know, I think there is a real kind of fear about this young generation. And you know, we have to kind of think about them in their historical context. They're, you know, coming of age in the era of both Obama and Trump, and the whole world kind of seems to be upside down and nothing seems right. And, you know, so I think it makes all the sense in the world to see that as a real threat to the status quo right now. The young people in this country are not happy.
And the interesting thing, too, from the state level, in particular FBI, some of the justification given is that they're targeting the points of, quote, radicalization, right? When people will radicalize, and then when they become older, they're enemies of the state or terrorists. And again, the irony there is there seems to be very little attention paid to where there has been radicalization, right, in terms of white supremacy and these types of things. And that, I mean, obviously the Southern Poverty Law Center and other groups, you know, pay attention to these things, but we don't see a lot of attention paid, you know, to the kind of radicalization that's actually happening.
Right. You're pointing out that we're not seeing enough attention being made on the way that the government is kind of targeting youth in these ways. But, you know, in some senses, there's nothing new about that. Black, Latinx, indigenous youth in this country have long been the targets in their schools and their communities of all kinds of repression, all kinds of policing strategies, many of which we're seeing today is long ago kind of been worked out on the laboratories of those communities. Right. So, yeah, I think that the ways that, you know, for example, that Muslim, Arab, South Asian communities and children are being policed right now is not that different the way than how Black and brown communities and youth have long been policed and treated in this country.
And I had sort of three points I wanted to make on the specific use of a group or a tactic and a reactionary legislative proposal to that. So we see one area which is criminalizing sort of ex post facto, there will be a tactic used, and then there will be a law passed to eliminate the ability to protest or dissent using that tactic. So we see contemplated and enacted state legislation about mass picketing that hinders the pursuit of work, which has been done before, blocking traffic, which has been done before. We already talked about prohibiting wearing any kind of facial coverings, boycotts, protests of elected officials, and then we also see trying youth protesters as adults in some of these proposals. And there were two other points I wanted to make in the tailoring of penalties to tactics that have been used in the past. There are penalties specific to tampering with equipment or infrastructure and trespassing, and these we see tied to the company interest, whether it's building the pipeline or with fracking, anti-fracking protests and things like that, the companies and legislators colluding to target these specific ways of outlawing waves of protests that had been successful in the past. And then the one thing that we haven't talked about is actual depenalizing or reduction of penalties for injuring or killing protesters. There have been reductions for example, in North Dakota, hitting a protester with a vehicle. So I wanted to make those points and let you take it.
I mean, I think this last point that Caitlin brought up is really crucial. You know, when we're thinking about this kind of wave of right-wing vigilantism and violence that we're seeing, this is being facilitated, emboldened, enabled, actually, by what's happening at the level of legislation and state and at the political level, which I guess is not that surprising when the president of this country is officially endorsed by the Ku Klux Klan, right? But the violence, there have been many cases of right-wing violence being targeted at protesters in the past year. And in most of those cases, we've seen a complete refusal of the state to actually prosecute. In very limited cases are we seeing prosecution for that. And in fact, what we're seeing instead is what Caitlin brought up, is these actually efforts to pass legislation that essentially immunizes that kind of vigilante violence. So there are actually three different states where there are proposals to, you know, remove any liability for drivers who, quote, accidentally hit and injure or even kill protesters or demonstrators. So essentially, it's a level of kind of the state sanctioning of that kind of vigilante violence, which really kind of captures the terror that is being imposed upon people right now for dissent, right?
I mean, it's, those are like stand your ground laws with a vehicle.
Exactly.
Where if you run over somebody, if you don't mean to, that apparently that you're not liable.
Right.
That's certainly, you know, if you're going to drive a car through a crowd, you hit some people who are protesting out in the street, apparently there's legislation now that's going to say, well, that's not your fault.
Which is not, I hate to say this, which is not an uncommon occurrence. I've witnessed that numerous times. There was a case that received quite a deal of publicity around that here in Oakland a few years ago, where during Occupy Oakland, where a driver did actually just ram right into people that were marching in the street.
The Occupy movement, which you wrote about, certainly we know that nationally the police departments were coordinated by the Police Executive Research Forum, where they set up telephone communications with all the major police chiefs around the country as to how to deal with Occupy, how to infiltrate the groups and how to do that. We see this continuing now by the addition of private mercenary groups up in North Dakota, Tiger Swan and G4S, infiltrating groups, sabotaging them, identifying the people that are involved, cooperating with the police in a variety of ways, but also doing their own repression and violence against these groups. And private companies can in fact hire them for that. So we see this expanding across the country. Also this idea, and I'll let you talk about this a little bit, economic terrorism. If you're interfering with the profits of a company, you can be a terrorist. How is that working?
That's one example that illustrates that a lot of these developments we're seeing that we are associating with being with the Trump era have actually preceded it, and these are kind of shifts that have been slowly progressing for a while now, because these efforts to rebrand dissent as terrorism are not new. It become very common in the post 9/11 period, right? There we have this whole new genre of environmental terrorism, et cetera. With economic terrorism, you know, in the case of, you brought up Occupy Oakland, in the case of Occupy Oakland, one of the most kind of successful actions that Occupy Oakland undertook was a day of a general strike, during which the movement shut down the port of Oakland for one day in response to the police repression of the movement. And there were all kinds of efforts here by local politicians to characterize the protest at the port as a form of economic terrorism, because it infringed upon essentially the profits of companies like EGT that operate in the port. So, we should really just assume that it is a given that there is extensive cooperation between government and capital in these repressive activities, that there's all kinds of profits involved for many people, and that yes, there's a level of national coordination across the board. We know about that national coordination related to the Police Executive Research Forum when it came to the Occupy movement, simply because a conversation between these different 19 mayors was revealed to have happened. But there was actually nothing uncommon about that fact, that level of national coordination and the involvement of private industries in it is very common in this day and age right now.
We're speaking with Lale Behbahanian and Caitlin Henry. We're talking about political repression of dissent. And we are going to conclude our conversation after this break. Once again, I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips, and you're listening to the Project Censored Show. Please stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today we've been speaking about political repression and dissent, and we left off, wanted to bring up one last point here about the history of this kind of criminalization of dissent, and we've seen in post-9/11 one of the really obscure but really kind of damaging kind of laws that we saw come about was something called the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, and there are, of course, others associated with that. Would you all like to talk a little bit about the genesis of that?
Mm-hmm. The early 2000s, the precursor was the Animal Enterprise Protection Act. It mm-hmm. converted to the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, and it came from companies that wanted more punitive measures for people who were hurting their bottom line. So people who were chalking outside of their companies, rallying or doing anything to harm their profits. And there were a number of prosecutions, the Shack 6 and other six under that material support statute. What's interesting in particular is the low-level penalties that come with some of these base charges are exacerbated by enhancements. So you'd have a base charge of some kind of property destruction, and that wouldn't normally carry that long of a charge. But these enhancements, or the definition of it as terrorism, prolong the sentences. They can be consecutive or concurrent, which can mean shorter or longer times based on those enhancements. And when people are also associated with political groups, there's a different set of charges that's being used, and those are material support charges. And so people are accused of associating with some kind of, quote, terrorist organization, and the Treasury keeps a list of those informed by Secretary of State, and also that informs the travel ban, not the travel ban we're talking about right now under the executive order, but the no-fly list and other restrictions, the SSS security screening. So this interferes with people's ability to move freely. But the material support cases often result in people going to these new prisons that were created around the same time as the AETA, known as the communication management units. And those are folks who are held in extremely high security level federal facilities that are akin to ADX in Florence and Supermax, but they're low-level, short sentence time periods. They're not serious offenses, but because they are folks who provide, quote, inspirational value, I believe is some of the internal communications that were leaked from the Bureau of Prisons, they're segregated from other populations. And this is, as Lale was talking about before with the MMSA community, really racialized and has to do with controlling certain religious groups. So they were first called Little Guantanamos because there were so many Arab and Muslim people there. But in order to be less politically hot button, they moved a lot of Black Muslim converts who were also seen as politically threatening to the Bureau of Prisons. And then they started moving in more of the white eco and environmental prisoners that they described as terrorists. So I think that's an important part to talk about, the whole breadth of both how the law is enforced, who's criminalized, how long the times they're doing are, and then what the actual conditions they're going to be under. And one last part, when people have those convictions, they often have a long term of supervision, and the marshals and federal probation will actually violate them for writing up articles talking about the conditions, talking about the CMUs, and try to send them back to prison for First Amendment sort of speech and association. That's the last point I want to make. Thank you.
Caitlin Henry, thank you very much. Lalai Behbahanian, some last thoughts on these topics.
What's really important to remember in this moment, because I think that this can all be really alarming, terrifying, and that's the intent, right? The intent is to kind of quell and crush resistance in this country. But I think it's important to remember that the intensity of that repression is really a reflection of the level of resistance in this country right now. And I do think that we also need to keep in mind that what kind of distinguishes this historical moment is a really kind of unprecedented level of solidarity between different groups and a willingness of all kind of people to and a commitment to really resist the things going on and to take care of each other and defend each other. And so, you know, as I get increasingly kind of disillusioned by what's going on, I remember that as that's really the context in which we're struggling right now.
Indeed. And just for the last thing, is there any websites or any things that either of you would like to share for people that want to find out more about what you're both doing?
Well, definitely people should check out the National Lawyers Guild write-up of the legislation that's going on their site. But also I would encourage people to check out the Bay Area Anti-Repression Committee's website, which has a lot of information about different forms of repression and ways to support those who face repression.
And the website is?
It's antirepression.org.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And NLG.org is National Lawyers Guild.
Yes.
And Caitlin, do you have?
One last one. DefendJ20Resistance.org talks about the case of people protesting at the inauguration, and that has not received much media attention, and it's important for people to know how the Sessions DOJ calling for this federal prosecution is really, really harmful for everyone.
And indeed, that story has been so underreported, it's in the running for the next censored top 25, which is unfortunate, but certainly an issue that needs far more attention. And I'd like to thank the both of you for all the really important and incredible work that you're doing. And thanks so much for joining us on the Project Censored show today.
Thank you for having
us.
After this brief break, we'll continue and we'll be talking about the Golden Rule Project. Helen Jacquard and Jerry Condon will discuss the history of the peace boat, the Golden Rule, and their current voyage along the California coast. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. For the remainder of the program today, we are going to interview activists with Veterans for Peace about the Golden Rule Project. So here is Peter Phillips to introduce our guests to you. Peter?
Our two Veterans for Peace guests are Helen Jacquard and Jerry Condon. They are part of the Golden Rule Peace Boat, which is cruising the California coast and Sacramento River in June. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Helen, what's the historical significance of the Golden Rule, the sailboat?
In 1958, four Quaker activists sailed the Golden Rule towards the Marshall Islands in an attempt to stop atmospheric nuclear bomb testing there. And they made it as far as Honolulu and were brought back to port by the Coast Guard twice. A second boat, the Phoenix of Hiroshima, actually did finish the voyage into the Marshall Islands, and partly as a result of the public outcry over the Golden Rule's crew being arrested, but also as a result of their preparation for this voyage. In 1963, President Kennedy signed the Limited Nuclear Test Ban Treaty with the UK and the USSR. In 2010, the Golden Rule had been neglected and drifting around in Humboldt Bay Northern California, and she sank in a gale. She was brought up onto the shore of Leroy Zerlang's boatyard. He was going to use her for firewood when he found out from the previous owner that she'd played an important role in the Cold War. He did some research about the Golden Rule and decided to put her up for sale, and the Smithsonian Institute and some other organizations were interested in her. But Veterans for Peace, the Garberville and Eureka chapters, showed up on the scene and said, "Leroy, we'll restore this boat for you, and it'll take about a year in your boatyard. Is that okay?" And he says, "Yes, let's restore this boat." And 5 years later, we put her in the water. So in 2015, the Golden Rule sailed on her new maiden voyage down to San Diego for the Veterans for Peace National Convention there, and in time for Hiroshima and Nagasaki Days, which we participated in. And then we made 10 ports of call on the way back up to Eureka for the following winter. In 2016, we sailed to Oregon, Washington, and British Columbia, doing 23 educational presentations about nuclear issues today. And we also participated in 4 wooden boat shows, as well as 4 on-the-water demonstrations against specific military activities.
Yeah, so this will be our 3rd year sailing for a nuclear-free world. We are a project, the national project of Veterans for Peace.
And this is Jerry. I just want to remind listeners, this is the voice of Jerry Condon. Go ahead, Jerry.
Yes, hi. So, yes, Veterans for Peace has adopted the Golden Rule as a national project and part of our ongoing work for nuclear disarmament. As part of our program, we're a 32-year-old organization, and our statement of purpose includes reducing and eventually eliminating all nuclear weapons, as well as abolishing war altogether. So this year, we're very much excited about the United Nations initiative to negotiate a treaty to ban nuclear weapons. That's happening right now. It initiated in April and May. There's a little hiatus right now, and they're going to come back in mid-June and finish this treaty. And even though it's opposed by the U.S. and the other nuclear powers, it's going to pass overwhelmingly in the U.N. General Assembly in early July. So we are dedicating our voyage throughout California this summer to build support for the U.N. treaty to ban nuclear weapons.
I'm looking at your schedule that you're going to be involved in. You leave Eureka on June 10th. And then you're in Fort Bragg on the 11th, but then you're down in Bodega Bay. I live very close to there and looking forward to that. You'll be there for a couple, 3 nights. And you're also engaged in speaking at different organizations. But on the 15th of June, you arrive at the Doran Beach Coast Guard Station. And I guess you're going to stay there. And then on June 17th, you're actually speaking in Santa Rosa along with Norman Solomon, challenging the warfare state. So we think that's real important. But then you're going to go up the Sacramento River, visit a lot of different towns, and then go all the way down to San Diego and continue a trip even beyond that. So what's happens after San Diego?
Well, we're going to winter over in San Diego, and then we're going to truck the Golden Rule across to Texas and sail the Intracoastal Waterway in 2018. And then we'll probably spend 2 years along the Eastern Seaboard, visiting towns along the way to talk about nuclear war and other nuclear issues. Then we'll go through the St. Lawrence Waterway and sail all over the Great Lakes and then down the Mississippi River. Our hope is to ultimately join up with the Phoenix of Hiroshima and sail across together to Honolulu, the Marshall Islands, Japan, and then back over to Alaska and down the West Coast. So we have both a all-around the United States tour and all-around the Pacific tour planned.
And Veterans for Peace chapters are going to be supporting you everywhere, I believe. I see a picture of the boat here. It's a really beautiful old wooden boat with red sails, a big peace sign on them, and Veterans for Peace on the sails, so the message is quite clear. So, Jerry, will you be on this whole voyage?
Helen and I will be accompanying the Golden Rule, occasionally as crew, but also as shore support and organizing these events as we go along. And we're really excited about the first couple events, which are in Fort Bragg. We have a really strong event. And Linda Williams, who's an anti-nuclear physicist, is going to be speaking at the event in Fort Bragg. And that is on Tuesday, June 13th at Silver's at the Wharf, right down there on Harbor Drive on Noyo Bay. And 6 p.m. dinner and drink, 7 p.m. presentation. And then Norman Solomon, we're very happy, is going to be, noted author and media activist, is going to be a featured speaker at the Santa Rosa event. And that's going to be on Saturday, June 17th, 7 p.m. at the Veterans Memorial Hall in Santa Rosa. We're going to then be coming into San Francisco Bay, and we're going to be around the bay for a little over a week, and we're doing what we call a peace action and sailing camp there, where we're going to have a number of youth and elders as well joining us. We're going to combine nonviolence and direct action training with training on anti-nuclear issues and learning how to sail. So that's pretty exciting, and people are interested in that. Joining us for that, they can reach us at 206-992-6364. That's 206-992-6364, or check out our website for more information, and that is VFP, as in Veterans for Peace, VFP, Golden Rule Project. .org. And then also, finally, as far as events go, we're going to be having an event in San Francisco on Tuesday, June 27th at the Veterans Memorial Building right down there on 401 Van Ness Avenue in the Civic Center of San Francisco, 7 p.m. So got a lot going on, and we're really excited about it, and we're getting in the final stages now of getting the Golden Rule ready to sail.
That sounds really great. I'm anxious to come out and see you at Bodega Bay on June 15th and 16th. And anybody interested in following that schedule, it's VFP, GoldenRuleProject.org, or call 206-992-6364 for the schedule. And we really appreciate your involvement with this.
And again, the website is VFP, as in Veterans for Peace, VFP Golden Rule Project. That's all together, VFPGoldenRuleProject.org. I just want to make sure we have that website out there clearly, because there is a lot of information on that site about history, news and updates and upcoming events. And this is, again, a very historic series of events, and it's from a long lineage of anti-nuclear activists and anti-war activists. And again, that's tied in with current activities at the United Nations to outlaw and ban nuclear war.
And people are also welcome to join the kayak welcome. We're going to have people in kayaks coming out to welcome us into Bodega Bay on Thursday afternoon, June 15th, around 4 p.m. So you can find out more information about that also.
Jerry Condon, VFP Golden Rule Committee President. Helen Jacquard, VFP Golden Rule Project Manager. Thanks so much for joining the Project Censored Show today.
Thank you.
Thank you guys for having us. Great work.
Thanks so much.
We want liberated land, supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians. 'Cause they owned by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain. But my people getting tired of the pain and the shame.
You're listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff. Peter Phillips and I are executive producers of the program, while Anthony Fest is our producer. Nolan Higdon and Nicholas Bayham III are co-hosts, as is Desiree McSwain. The Project Censored Show airs on nearly 40 stations around the U.S., from Maui to New York. All of our shows are archived online at projectcensored.org. To learn more about the show, go to projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. We'll see you next time.
About criminal minds, political ties, habitual eyes, alibis, disguise, and other guys of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fought for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, and the times for the master thief. Combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame. At the table, then you're probably on the menu.
We got that love, we flip the brothers in a